it does seem that they must have been working with others with the kind of experience and technical capability to pull off these outrageously violent attacks.
Sri Lanka investigates the series of deadly Easter bombings. It's Tuesday, April 23rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Taiwan looks to clamp down on fake news. Measles spread around the world. More electric cars roll out. 3D printing new hearts and planting trees to clean the air. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Sri Lanka is invoking emergency powers in the aftermath of the devastating coordinated bombings that turned Easter Sunday festivities into a national tragedy, killing at least 290 people and wounding more than 500 others. The 9 blasts mainly targeted churches and luxury hotels in the country's deadliest violence since its civil war ended a decade ago. The blasts destroyed ceilings and blew out windows. People carried victims out of blood-spattered pews. Health Minister Rajitha Senarate says authorities suspect foreign links, even though all of the suicide bombers were Sri Lankan citizens from a domestic Muslim militant group named National Taufik Jamaath. Police say 13 suspects have been arrested, although there was no immediate claim of responsibility. Alan Keenan is the International Crisis Group's Sri Lanka senior analyst. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with him via Skype from London.
It's really come as a shock. There was never any history of violence of this sort against Christians, and certainly not by any by the Muslim group that the government is claiming is responsible for this. There's been no history of Islamic militancy within Sri Lanka, and indeed Muslims have been extremely restrained as a community in the face of severe violence that they have been suffering the last 5 or 6 years from groups of Sinhalese Buddhists who say that they're defending the Buddhist character of the country against the supposed Islamic threat. So it all came out of nowhere, really, it seems.
So I take it this leads to the assumptions that are being made that this comes from not only internal sources, but international sources, correct?
Right. That's why I think a lot of people have turned elsewhere to look for the source of this violence, which is not to let the, if indeed those the government has arrested are responsible. Obviously, they need to be held to account. But it does seem that they must have been working with others with the kind of experience and technical capability to pull off these outrageously violent attacks.
Now, this is not to say that Sri Lanka does not have a history of violence.
Indeed, and that's sort of the paradox here, because when everyone woke up to these terrible attacks, the assumption was they must have come from one of the many existing or past lines of conflict in Sri Lanka. And Sri Lanka has seen terrible political violence. It saw 30 years of civil war between government forces and the Tamil Tigers, who were demanding a separate Tamil state in the north and east of the island. It has seen uprisings by Sinhalese from the majority community, leftist nationalist Sinhalese in the 1970s and 1980s, where tens of thousands of people died. It has seen mob attacks against Muslims quite recently by these Buddhist militant groups. It has seen also attacks, sort of lower scale, lower level attacks on Christian churches, on principally evangelical Christian churches by militant Buddhist groups as well. So, I mean, it's had lots of violence. It's had political assassinations, massacres, enforced disappearances. I mean, it's had a terrible history. It's still standing. And for them, 10 years after the end of the civil war, for this new form of violence to emerge has really shocked and depressed and scared a lot of people. I work for a conflict resolution and prevention and mitigation organization, and so I'm always trying to think ahead to what might come next and how potential future violence could be prevented or reduced. So what worries me are the consequences of this violence on the fragile and tense relationships between the different communities in Sri Lanka. So particularly, as I was saying, there has been this campaign, which has often taken violent forms, against Muslims, presenting them in Sri Lanka as a threat to the island, to its political stability, to the Buddhist character of the island. And Until now, there's really been no tangible evidence that there is any kind of physical threat from Muslims to anybody else, because Muslims have been a very calm, conservative, minority who knew that if they caused trouble, they would suffer more than anybody else. So they've been very restrained in responding to the attacks on them. But now we actually do have what appears to be a direct and quite severe act of violence by at least some Sri Lankan Muslims. So the worry is this will be used to justify further and perhaps even worse attacks on Sri Lanka, on Sri Lankan Muslims, or simply, people will be angry. Perhaps some Christians will be angry at what's happened to them and their loved ones. So I think levels of volatility, political volatility, were already quite high in Sri Lanka. And there has been this long history of violence, which may not explain these attacks, but sets a context in which these attacks could provoke or be used to justify further violence. So it's absolutely essential that government leaders, business leaders, and crucially religious leaders from all the main communities work together to caution people against holding the entire Muslim community responsible for what may have been, and I again say may have been, the acts of a small number of their community.
The reports that we have all heard over the past 24 hours or so are saying that there might have been a tip coming from Indian intelligence that was not picked up upon. What do you know about that, if anything?
Well, I know what's been in, what's been published. It does. There was a briefing, an internal sort of report by the Deputy Inspector General of Police to some of his senior colleagues, including the political leadership, reporting this warning, which appears to have come from Indian intelligence sources, that there would be a plan of suicide attacks on churches and apparently also potentially on the Indian High Commission in Colombo. The problem was this report came just as Sri Lanka was about to enjoy its long New Year break about 10 days ago. So it may have sort of just fallen through the cracks of everyone going home on vacation, but it probably also suffered from the deep divisions within the government between the president, who holds the portfolio of defense and law and order, which means he's in charge of the entire security apparatus, including the police and intelligence agencies. And on the other side, the prime minister from a different party, whom the president hates and tried to get rid of through unconstitutional means in the end of last year, which caused quite a constitutional crisis. So we know that the government is deeply divided and apparently dysfunctional not only on other policies, which has been pointed out many times, but perhaps also on security issues, which has led to a lot of people being afraid of what could be coming next if the government doesn't get its act together.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Alan Keenan, the International Crisis Group's Sri Lanka senior analyst. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. North Korea's strategy, slam everyone but Trump. Amazon curtailing business operations in China. Vietnam to encourage environmentally friendly building design. Cambodian and Thai leaders mark reopening of rail link. Observers warn the future prospects of two Dalai Lamas. Where do you find expanded coverage of all these stories? Well, how about going to Facebook at VOA Asia? You can also stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A Taiwan television network quoted a farmer last month saying the price of pomelos was so low last year that he threw 1.2 million kilograms of the grapefruit-like produce into a reservoir. Taiwan's National Communications Commission says the farmer actually sold his fruit. Last year, the government protested news reports saying Taiwan's office in Osaka had not arranged to rescue Taiwanese tourists stranded at a typhoon-flooded Japanese airport. Japanese authorities had closed off the airport, the government here said, just to about all of unnecessary traffic, And cases such as these prompted the government to approve a series of draft legal changes aimed at stopping the spread of misinformation. The laws, more often found in authoritarian Asian states rather than the region's democracies, are expected to discipline Taiwan's freewheeling news outlets along with social media. Social media scholars like Ku Lin Lin, associate journalism professor at National Taiwan University, says the revised laws could instill more trust in a society already divided over major issues, such as ties with political rival China. But deciding what reports constitute fake news may fall into the hands of government officials worried about the next election, she says, and quick prosecution would give the government an upper hand in controlling the media.
I think the administration wants to create more, like you can say, tools or weapons to attack or counterattack fake news. They need something to penalize the media. They need something more concrete.
But on the definition of fake news, Ku says that these laws give a very clear message to the people that the government has the final say. Taiwan's ruling party-dominated parliament must approve the legal revisions before they take effect. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. Happening now in Asia, Japanese prosecutors have indicted jailed former chairman of Nissan Motor Company, Carlos Ghosn, on a fresh charge of aggravated breach of trust under Japan's Companies Act. His fourth charge comes on the day his detention period had been set to expire. Ghosn denies all the allegations against him. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Today, as we observe World Immunization Week, we're going to focus on a disease that could be eradicated from the earth, just like smallpox was, and just as international programs are doing with polio. But instead, as we hear from Carol Pearson, this potentially deadly disease is making a comeback.
Measles is a disease that is found only in humans, so it could be completely wiped off the face of the earth, just like smallpox was. But despite a highly effective and safe vaccine, measles is making a comeback. In just the first 3 months of this year, the World Health Organization reports that cases of measles has tripled over last year. In Africa, the situation is worse. Africa saw a 700% increase compared to last year.
Madagascar has almost 1,000 deaths. It has, you know, tens of thousands of infections.
This is Brooklyn, New York, where a measles outbreak among Hasidic Jews prompted the mayor to declare a state of emergency. The National Institutes of Health warns that a decline in measles vaccination is causing a preventable global resurgence of this often deadly disease, including in the U.S. Before the vaccine became available in the 1960s, about 2 million people around the world would die from measles. In the U.S., 3 to 4 million people were infected every year.
1 in 10 children who get infected with measles will get an ear infection that could cause deafness. 1 in 20 would get pneumonia. 1 in 1,000 would get brain swelling, what we call encephalitis. And 1 to 3 per 1,000 would die. So to say that measles is a trivial disease is completely incorrect.
The complications are even worse in poor countries.
You start off with children who are already at greater risk. They may be malnourished. They may have immune system compromise. They may have underweight, and they may have no access to health care. So measles is a big killer.
You have a 90% chance of getting measles if you haven't been vaccinated and you come in contact with someone who has it.
So it's very infectious. And so it will find everybody who is not protected against measles.
The solution is to get two doses of the measles vaccine. That may mean educating parents about the disease and the vaccine. Equally important is making vaccination a priority of health systems worldwide. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, plugging in your next ride. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia: a strong earthquake in the northern Philippines left several people dead, trapping others in buildings, damaging the capital's secondary airport. The quake hit the main island of Luzon with a magnitude of 6.3, centered some 60 kilometers away from the capital city of Manila. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more details. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia as Ford is showing off its new fleet of electric vehicles. Some of the standouts include a new hybrid plug-in and the promise of an all-new, all-electric model by the year 2022. The U.S. automaker plans to have a fleet of 40 different electric vehicles on the roads within the next 3 years. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Ford believes the future of driving is electric. These cars are all new releases from the Ford Motor Company, and they are all either fully electric or hybrid, a combination of internal combustion and electric. They will help drivers comply with the low emission zones being imposed in European cities. These areas charge drivers a fee for driving high emission cars, but this new fleet will let you drive free of charge.
You can save with just a touch of a button the electric energy in the battery and use the internal combustion engine to drive the car to London, and then you enter the borders of London, and then you can switch on electric and the car drives emission-free in the city environment.
Ford's most popular car in Europe is the Transit, and the company has slowly been moving the car away from internal combustion and towards hybrids. Ford Europe Chairman Steve Armstrong says his company is ready to get these cars on the road.
We've had a fleet trial running in London for the last 12 months with 16 of our customers. And using the lessons we've learned from that fleet trial, we're actually going to go into full production later this year, and people will be able to see those vehicles on the streets across Europe by the end of this year.
A fully electric version will hit the streets in 2021.
All of the technologies are new. It's the latest generation of battery technology. It's the latest generation of e-motor technology. And then, of course, it's the latest generation of technologies mating the electric motors via the transmissions to the engines.
Ford says it is developing a fully electric passenger van with a range of 150 kilometers and a sports car with a 600 kilometer range. And those will be available 2020. Armstrong says they are just doing what's necessary to compete in a world that is increasingly mandating climate consciousness.
Electrification, of course, is going to be a very big part of our industry as we move to new types of propulsion to lower our CO2 emissions primarily. So you'll see more electrification news coming from us in the future. Next year, we will have our first full electric, which is a Mustang-inspired performance SUV.
To support the cars, a consortium of car companies is working to open 400 charging stations across Europe by next year. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia: the leaders of Cambodia and Thailand met at a Thai border town to mark the ceremonial reopening of a rail link that will restore train service between the two countries after more than four decades. The two leaders signed an agreement on operating the cross-border rail link. Take a ride daily at VOA Asia Facebook. It makes stops at all the big stories. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists in Israel have revealed what they say is the world's first 3D printed heart. It uses human tissue. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us the hope is the small heart will pave the way for transplants without donors, a time when every hospital might have access to 3D organ printers.
The 3D heart includes, for the first time, cells, blood vessels, ventricles, and chambers. Produced by researchers at Tel Aviv University, the tiny heart is the size of a rabbit's. But Professor Tal Dvir says it is a scientific breakthrough.
This is the first time that the whole cellular heart with blood vessel is printed. And another major breakthrough is that it is printed from the materials of the patient itself.
The team reprogrammed cells taken from a small biopsy to become stem cells, and then differentiated them to become cardiac cells and cells that form blood vessels.
And the biomaterial, the collagen and the other sugars that in the tissue, is processed to become a bioink. And together, when mixed, we have bioinks for the heart and bioinks for the blood vessels. And then we use a 3D printer to print whole hearts with the measured blood vessels.
It takes 3 hours to print one heart, measuring about 2.5 centimeters. Doctoral student Adav Noor says it will take several years of technological development before they can create a full-size, functional, pumping heart.
I'm not sure it's going to serve ourselves in the recent in the next few years, but for our children, I think it's going to be maybe an amazing opportunity, especially for heart disease patients.
The researchers hope that in 10 years, every hospital will own printers that can make tissues and organs to be transplanted into patients. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Scientists say cutting greenhouse gas emissions is not enough to prevent the worst impacts of climate change. We need to be pulling carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere out of it. And one of the best ways to do that is also one of the oldest Earth Day rituals, planting trees. Students, activists, and ordinary people have done this for Monday's Earth Day observance. Major corporations have signed on to an initiative to plant 100 million trees around the world by 2022. Even oil giant Shell has pledged $300 million over the next 3 years to a major reforestation effort. A project in the eastern United States is working to restore forests to the mountains of Appalachia, scarred by decades of coal mining. VOA's Steve Barragona grows our story.
Deep within West Virginia's Monongahela National Forest lies a rare stand of virgin woods.
Living in the east, there's not many places that you can go and be untouched by man.
Shane Jones is a biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. He says a mapping mistake spared these trees when the surrounding forest was logged decades ago. That's good, because red spruce forests like this one excel at taking planet-warming carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and locking it away in the soil.
See all that organic material?
It's black because it's incredibly high in carbon.
The mountains of Appalachia have lost 90% of their red spruce forests to logging and coal mining. Burning that coal for energy is adding more and more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. As the planet warms, scientists say the need for forests to remove that CO2 is increasingly urgent. The University of Kentucky's Chris Barton says tropical rainforests get the most attention.
But here in the temperate region of the world, in Appalachia, 4 hours away from Washington, D.C., we have billions of trees that potentially we could be planting.
Where better, Barton says, than here on the remains of old strip mines? That's one reason Barton started a group called Green Forests Work, to put trees back on the roughly 400,000 hectares of Appalachian forests that have been strip mined away. But there's a problem with many of these lands.
If you went out and planted trees on these sites, they just didn't grow. The ground was way too, you know, compacted. Water didn't infiltrate. Roots can't penetrate. Oxygen can't circulate in those environments.
The solution looks more like a Game of Thrones battleground than a forest in the making. Ripping up the compacted ground will let the trees they plant put down roots. They're starting to see results. Forests are coming back on the grounds they've ripped up and replanted. Around the world, experts say, nature offers powerful tools to fight climate change. Nature works slowly, they say, but it works. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Elkins, West Virginia.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us, of course, online, iTunes and SoundCloud, VOA Asia Facebook, and our website, voanews.com. If you've missed any part of our program, you can go there and hear the entire program full length available to you, as well as to download and take it with you as a podcast. You can also hear us on the radio, PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. We thank everyone listening there today. As we thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Thomas Blondet, managing editor Diane Gao, and Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.